If you enjoy this podcast, please like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and visit our website at lifebetweenthevines.com.
This podcast is sponsored by Release Winery. Join us as the story of this ultra-limited wine continues. Learn more at releasewinery.com.
Being influenced by outside ideas and thought, and for me to have worked in the 90s in Saint-Emilion in the right bank, and being able to see so much of the ideas that were so important to wine and would become so important to wine was something that changed my life.
Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 475. This week we feature Stu Smith, owner of Smith Madron Winery on Spring Mountain in Napa Valley. Since the start of this podcast over 13 years ago, I've interviewed Stu Smith of Smith Madron Winery on Spring Mountain many times. I've always enjoyed his candor and humor. He's a very smart guy. This was one of the most fun and highly educating interviews I've done with Stu. It's also one of the few times we had an audience during the recording. Speedy and Lisa Baldwin were at the winery for a tasting and sat in on the recording, making for a good time. Stu has owned Smith Madron for 50 years now. Think about that before you listen. A fantastic accomplishment. Cheers to you, Stu. Special thanks to Julianne Kotmer for arranging the interview. If there's one winery that we've really tried to come to as often as we can, it's Smith Madron on Spring Mountain. And we are here today with one of the partners, Stu Smith. Stu, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
We've been here a number of times over the year, and I don't really think I can come here enough. This is one of the most peaceful places around. It's beautiful, and you're just devilishly handsome.
Well, I don't know about that part, but I come here more often than you, and I find it also extremely soothing and peaceful and a lot of work, but it's gratifying.
Is it possible for you to take this for granted?
Only when I am extraordinarily busy and there's too much going on. Then I'm going flat out and I don't have time to enjoy anything other than just getting the work done.
Yeah. Well, getting the work done is the gig.
Yeah.
How many feet are we at roughly?
We're about 1900 feet here.
Okay. Pretty good distance. And we'll have some video around for our listeners to see. We're above the fog line where today has been fairly gloomy down on the valley floor. Up here, the sun is shining and it's great.
Right. It is a little chilly. We're just about 50 degrees Fahrenheit, 49, 50 degrees Fahrenheit. But if you're in the sun, it's great. And yesterday, the sun was out all day up here. And in the valley floor, by the way, I have a four-month-old puppy, English Springer Spaniel, running around. So if you hear some digging or other things or a bark, that's him. Or me barking at him not to do what's going on. And that brings up really the weather. The weather is very different from the valley floor to up here. In the summertime, we can be warmer in the morning than they are because the fog's down there. And in the evening times when the fog moves in, we're freezing up here and the valley floor is warm.
It's an incredible space. Before I go any further, I do want to say that we have some guests with us today that had come by here to taste. And the cool thing about these people is their names. Well, his name. Sorry, Lisa, you lose out. Speedy and Lisa Baldwin. I got that right?
Yes.
Great. Anybody named Speedy, I just like that.
I agree. I love the name, too.
Yeah. I want to rename myself.
Especially when you have Smith as a back.
Yes. And, of course, with us is Julianne Kotmer. And thank you very much for hanging out here, too. So this is the first time I think we've had an audience in a long time. How many acres are you farming up here?
Little over 38 acres.
Okay. And when you came here, 1971, 50 years ago, you and your brother Charlie, well, actually, you started it, right?
I did.
And then Charlie came on later on.
Yeah.
There were trees here, right?
The whole property was completely forested or would be considered reforested. There had been a vineyard here that originally was established in 1880. And then with phylloxera that came through the valley, California, in the late 1880s, all the vineyards were abandoned on the mountains. As a matter of fact, I still know of a few forests where you can walk through and see grape stakes throughout the forest.
Oh, really? Wow. So there's a lot of history up here. Is that pre the turn of the century?
Pre-20th century.
Yeah.
And then we have a 1905 St. Helena Star article that says all the vineyards on Spring Mountain have been abandoned because of phylloxera.
Wow, that's crazy. Yeah. What a rich history, though. Is it documented very well as to who and what was up here or no?
It all depends on your point of view, your perspective, I guess. We think there's a certain amount of recorded history up here. There's not nearly as much history that, recorded history has got lost. And getting accurate history is also very difficult. Pride Mountain is just to the west of us, and there was an old Ghost winery on their property.
Sure, I've seen that.
Owned by Lily Coit, as in Coit Tower, and the fire hose nozzle in San Francisco. And that building burned down. And there's a certain amount, the cave as you drive by coming down here, it was dug in 1880. So there's a certain amount of history up here.
When you were ready to do this, was it because of the wineries that were here? Did you see something in it that you knew was going to pay off for you, or at least you had a feel for it?
My drive was to get into the wine business to make as great a wine as I could. I didn't realize, I'm not a particularly avid art type person, but in some ways that's really what I turned out to be, unbeknown to me, which is that we established an artisanal winery before I even knew what the word artisanal was or it existed. And it was never the goal to make gobs of money. It was a goal, if you would, a quest to make great wine. And I came to the mountains because, as Virgil said in 43 BC, Bacchus amat colus, Bacchus loves the hills. And all things being equal, the best grapes come from the mountains. There's two kind of unassailable concepts, the fundamental concepts in wine quality, and that is you have to have great grapes to make great wine. You cannot yet, and hopefully never will, be able to take ordinary grapes and turn them into great wine. The second one is that the mountains produce, all things being equal, the best quality grapes, year in and year out. And that's because the grapes have to struggle up here. They don't have the fertility, they don't have the water, and they produce a grape which the vines have to struggle, and that the berry is smaller, and all of the flavor is in the skins. The color and flavor is in the skin of the grape. And so if you think about a beach ball, a huge beach ball, and you think about the skin of the beach ball versus the volume of water, there's a very low ratio of skin to juice. If you're looking at a golf ball, baseball, golf ball, grape berry, you have a much higher ratio of skin to the juice. And that's one of the issues, but the other issue is the grapes just have to struggle. They have to work hard, and that kind of is reminiscent that everything we do on the mountain, as almost any wine grower does in any mountainous region in the world where they grow grapes, is that there's no easy way of doing anything. It's all hard, and if there's two ways of doing it, and one's easy and one's hard, the easy way probably is the wrong way to do it. And just getting used to doing things the hard way is just a way of life up here.
Being on a mountain. Had to be a lonely time up here doing this. What was your first actual vintage?
First legal vintage was 77.
Okay.
We planted the grapes. We cleared the property in the summer of 71. We got a logging permit from California Department of Forestry to log the vineyard so we could reclaim the vineyard, which we did. And then in 72, I think Charlie joined me in 72 or late 72, we planted the vineyard. And then we had our first crop in 74, and we just made wine for ourselves just to see how it was going. As a matter of fact, we made it in the cave up above. It's not our cave, unfortunately, but that's where we made the wine. And then we built the winery, Charlie and I, So as I like to say to visitors, don't look too closely. It hasn't fallen down yet. And we do everything ourselves.
That's the part that's the most impressive. How many cases, again, are you doing?
We do about 4,000 or 5,000 cases a year, depending on the vintage. We don't buy grapes.
Yeah, right.
And so it's really to the vagaries of Mother Nature. It's kind of like what I say about my children. I don't take credit and I don't take blame.
That's a good one. I like that. I'm going to use that. So in that time that you did this, especially because you're doing it for yourselves in the beginning, what was the craziest advice you ever got? I'm sure you got a lot of crazy advice.
The one that lingers with me for the longest is when I was a grad student doing my graduate work at UC Davis and telling my professors about what I was doing. They said, well, make sure you don't overwater them. And I'm going, okay, well, I'll figure that one out. And what we did is we planted it on our own roots, and the plants came in like little tomato plants in 4-inch plastic pots. Mm. And they stuck up about 5 inches from out of the pot. And they started growing. We planted them in the spring of 72. And when we planted them, all the leaves fell off because it was traumatic. You know, you pull them out of the pots, you put them in the water, you know, you water them, but then you got to come back and water and water and water. So I'd go around with my thumb, and I have, for some reason, really thick fingernails, and I just scraped, and it was green. So then they started growing again. It was like, okay. And then I spent that whole summer of 72 just watering. I called myself a basin engineer because I dug basins around them. I laid out black polyurethane hose all throughout the vineyard, filled it with water, filled it with tees, put it with valves, put it with spigots, and listened to the radio and music all summer long. I don't think I took a day off and just went around watering everything by hand to get the things up and going, and they got going. But it's always amused me because they must have thought something like, well, I'm going to be on some kind of rich valley soil where, you know, you don't want to overwater the little suckers. But that's the one thing that rang with me and sticks with me is the admonition of don't overwater them. And I'm going, it's impossible.
No kidding, especially up here. Do you have a hero in wine?
A hero. I'm not sure it's a hero, but maybe I do. I would say more of a model, a role model, a couple of them. One is Joe Heitz. When I was looking to figure out how to get into the wine business, I considered all different ways. I grew up in Southern California, and I thought, okay, well, after going to school, I'd go back to Southern California, try to make my fortune, and then buy my way into the business, which is what most people are doing today. Mm. Only they're doing it with like a bazillion dollars that they made in the Silicon Valley. And Joe Heitz, you know, came to it from an educational point of view. And he taught for a while and then started the winery and slowly by surely built the thing up. And one of my proudest memories of that time was I was at the vintners meeting and we just won a big award for our Riesling in a thing called the Wine Olympics 1979. A tasting that occurred in Paris put on by the French magazine Gaumont, and we won the German wine division. And he came around and put his arm on my shoulders, and he goes, and he doesn't talk much. He goes, way to go, kid. And I thought, wow, I've arrived. You know, if Joe Heitz is willing to do that, that's great. And then the other one is there's two guys, Chuck Carpi and Laurie Wood, who started Fremark Abbey. And if I had a role model, if I could be like anybody out there, it was them. They were, you know, just wonderful human beings and willing to give you all the time that you wanted to talk to them about issues. And so they were great. And then Andrei Chelyachev was an important mentor in that life. So those would be the four guys that I really looked up to and was very appreciative of their mentorship, what it was. I mean, I didn't work for any of them, but they accepted me into their kind of circle, and I was grateful for that. And then at UC Davis, Lloyd Leiter will always be endeared to me because I had at the time a Irish setter named Brandy, and Lloyd renamed her No Dog because every door in the school said No Dog allowed, because Brandy would go with me to every class and every room and whatever, and finally he just said, her name has changed.
Yeah, that's cool. I'm going to take a moment here to see if our gallery here would like to ask a question. I don't normally do this, so I'm going to do it for a change. I'm going to let my guard down. Speedy? Lisa? I just wanted to say Speedy, that's all. Not really.
So was it, if you could tell us a little more about, you talked about overwatering, but up here, you know, you've looked into dry farming and other things. You know, tell us a little more about your strategy or what you do.
Well, dry farming wasn't a goal when we started. It was the only way. Drip irrigation hadn't been invented yet. It was probably in the mid-70s, 75, 76. Salesman comes up, drives in, says, "Oh, I want to help you with something." You're going, "Oh yeah, right." And he goes, "Well, I got the new stuff, and it's from Israel, and it's called drip irrigation, and you know, if you want some, we'll give some to you free, and we'll see how it goes." And I said, "I'm good for anything that's free." So what it was is drip irrigation. And it was so different than today because our spacing was 12 foot between the rows and 6 feet between the vines. So they brought back a couple rows, a couple, you know, circular bundles of this stuff that was 12 feet between the emitters. And the emitters were such that they weren't punched into the drip hose. The drip hose was cut, and then they were plugged together from each end, kind of like a prong, and held together. And the idea was you would roll it down a row and irrigate it, and then you'd pull it 6 feet and irrigate it, you know, the vines next to it. Then you'd move it over to the other side, do one irrigation, move it another 6 feet, and do it again. And so you could even then flip it over the top of the vines and do another row and another row. And that's how primitive drip irrigation was. And then the drought of 1988 era came in, and we didn't have any water. And so I just said to the guys, "Look, we got no water. There's no reason to have drip irrigation. So let's just get rid of it." And we did. And what happened then is I realized is that the vines did as well as they did without water. And I started to anthropomorphize about the vines, thinking that what seems to be going on is that they seem to understand, in a way that I don't, what the natural environment of that vintage was. And so I think they started changing from a growth stage to a ripening stage, a vegetative state to a ripening stage, on a more natural timetable. And they took a little longer time from that point of veraison or beginning to ripen to maturity. And they didn't need the water because they seemed to sense how much was there in the ground. Now, that worked, and we did that until we got phylloxera again, almost 100 years from the previous time. Obvious before I was alive, but phylloxera hit the Napa Valley in the mid 80s, and we didn't get it up here until the mid 90s, late 90s. And what I didn't realize at that time, and we, you know, go back in history, we planted the initial vineyard on 20 acres on its own roots, and it was a bit of a gamble. The vineyard had been disappeared, and no grapevines, ergo no phylloxera. And the Douglas fir trees that were here were 24, 30 inches in diameter, 35 inches in diameter, some of them, when we logged them out. And so we were very careful not to use any equipment from the Napa Valley that might bring in phylloxera. And we planted 1 acre of AXR number 1 as a rootstock. And so We planted the initial 20 acres. It was 5 acres of Cabernet, 5 acres Pinot Noir, 5 acres of Chardonnay, and 5 acres of what we then called Johannesburg Riesling, and 1 acre of AXR number one. And then we started making our own bench grafts. And everything was fine. Everything, I mean, AXR is a wonderful rootstock. It grafts well, roots well, suppresses viruses well, drought tolerant, makes great wine, produces a good crop. It's only got one little itty bitty problem, and that is it is susceptible to phloxera because A stands for Aramon, which is a Vitis vinifera variety. And so then we move into the era of using new rootstocks starting around 2000. And we're looking at rootstocks which are 110R, 1103 Paulson, and 140 Ruggieri. And these are all rootstocks that are based on Vitis rupestris. And this is a rootstock out of Texas, but not near any water sources. Has very fine hairs, lifts water up from great depths with a fair amount of ease, and is very drought tolerant. So we started using, as a matter of fact, we've used all three of those, looking for which one is the best. And frankly, none of them are as good as AXR number one. Then in the valley floor, they're using Vitis riparia as their basis. And riparia, you might imagine, is along a riparian corridor, which is where it is found, again, in the Texas desert, but along waterways. Mm-hmm. And so it needs water, and so we clearly don't want to use that. And one of the things that I have been championing very unsuccessfully is for the industry to pay more attention to rootstocks, because the valley floor should be using less water. We should be, you know, we're trying to stay with dry farming or go at least get as close to dry farming as is humanly possible. But we really need better rootstocks. And we're dealing with rootstocks that are 100 years old. And water has never been an issue like it is today. And we should have better rootstocks because grapevines can deal with less water than any other agricultural product. And in this world of 7 billion of us, or however many there are of us, we need to have a rootstock where we use less water, not more water.
Good answer.
Long.
That's okay. Lisa, do you have a question at all? Or?
I think my question would be regards clones. What are some of your favorite clones and why?
Yeah. Clones is a discussion that can go on forever and ever with no end. But clones are important. And fortunately, we don't grow Pinot Noir any longer. Because if we grew Pinot Noir and I had to talk about clones, there's not enough hours in the days in the weeks, months in the years. There's just a huge number of Pinot Noir clones. And I believe that Domaine Carnera still uses the Smith Madrone clone of Pinot Noir.
Oh.
Because I lost, we had a fire, a house fire, and lost everything in 75. And with that went all the records of which clone was which. And so they'd gotten cuttings from us. So I think still to this day, they have a Smith Madrone Pinot Noir clone, they call it. Hmm. From the Riesling point of view, we liked the Geisenheim clone that we got in 1972 from FPMS, which was the Foundation Plant Material Service. The state of California. And then with Cabernet, we've tried a lot of different Cabernet clones, but we really like the clone 7 and 8. It produces a good crop, which is important because you have to make money in this business. You know, the idea is that you get into the wine business so that the vineyard and the winery feeds you. But so many vintners get into the wine business and 25, 30 years later, they're still feeding the winery. And I'm going, that is not a good economic model. And it messes with the industry when profit isn't the primary driving force for being in the business. As I like to say, there are so many vintners that lose money, and that if you were in Florida and making ball bearings, how long would you continue to make ball bearings if you were losing money? Not very long, I suspect.
Well, the main principle of any business, number one, prime directive, is to make a profit. And number two, profit is not a dirty word.
No, it's not, except in the wine business.
Well, yeah, that shouldn't be. I mean, it's a simple matter. You a lot of work goes into it.
Yeah, and yet we still, after 50 years in the wine business, everyone is still using, how do you make a small profit in the wine business? Start out with a large one. I mean, it's ridiculous.
The machine's got to be fed.
Yeah.
It's just how it works.
Yeah.
Which is impressive for me with you, and I've said this to you before, you've really kept a sane price on your wine for its value. I'm not afraid to say I'm a fan. I've said it before. I bought it before I met you. And your prices are still very reasonable for Napa wine.
Well, for Charlie and I, when we started this, they weren't inexpensive to us. They were expensive. We're just a normal middle-class family, and I happened to be at the very right place at the very right time and went through a door that I probably shouldn't have. But fingernails have been on the chalkboard of survival a lot of times, a lot of years in the past. And as I like to say, we don't do Corinthian columns here. We think a winery is a processing facility where grapes come in the front door and wine goes out the other door. And the wine doesn't know what the building is made of, what the architect was, how much money you spent on it, or anything else of that nature. And in fact, in some ways, I make a joke about the Napa Valley being akin to the Italian Renaissance, where the owners of these properties would turn to one another and go, my Duomo is bigger than your Duomo. my church painter is more famous than your church painter. And we've got a little bit of that going on in the Napa Valley now. And these are wineries that are being designed and built to massage some guy's ego.
In the end, it's about the wine.
And in the end, it's all about the wine. And the wine starts, the wine quality starts in the vineyard. And really starts and ends in the vineyard, because the day you harvest the grapes, that's the best that wine can ever be.
I think in the end, too, and it's just for my two cents, to see the beauty of the vineyard itself is its own thing. I appreciate. The vineyard went through an extraordinary year in 2020. Springer Mountain was hit very bad with the fires. You can see samples of it on the way coming up, and it's devastating. I can't even imagine what it was like here. What was your experience like? And just as a quick aside, your video that you did post was brilliant. I'm glad you did that for people to understand what you were dealing with.
Yeah, it's like a tragedy, a loss of a person. It haunts you. So we had 2020, which was both COVID and the fire. And Sam, my son, and I were up here the first several nights, and I spent every night up here. And if we hadn't have been here, who knows what would have happened? But we did as good a job as we could. Now, having said that, and we succeeded. We didn't lose any substantial buildings. But I guess maybe the way to start this or mention it is that my brother and I grew up in Santa Monica. And there were always fires in Southern California. And we just learned that fires were a way of life. And in fact, when my brother was 12 or 13 as a Boy Scout, he got hauled off to a fire in Malibu to help put it out. So, this is something that we've always dealt with. And when we came up here, we had that same feeling. Now, there's some interesting research that just came out. And that is that I don't know why they started in 1920, but between 1920 and 2000, all the major fires in California were in Southern California, mostly. And then starting in 2000, it transferred to Northern California. And so we don't have a lot of money, but when our crew is done with a harvest, and between harvest and beginning of pruning, we've spent a lot of time clearing out the forest and clearing out the underbrush. And one of the things I've always known is that our forests are overcrowded. And overcrowded forest means huge amounts of fuels, huge amounts of dead material, and a huge threat to us. So we've done our best, slowly, to fire harden the property. And that came into real prominence with the 2020 fire. And the winery, by happenstance, you know, through no intent on my part or my brother's part, we put the winery in just the right place. We've always been concerned about a strong north wind coming out of Bothe Napa Valley State Park, and that's where this fire came from. Charlie and I and Sam were doing harvest Sunday, and then we all went home around 7 o'clock that night, and then a friend of mine called and said, there's a fireball above your place, you got to get back up there. So we came back up. Charlie couldn't get through the roadblock. Sam got through the roadblock and basically said going through Spring Mountain Road was pretty hairy because it was all on fire. I got through about 20 minutes earlier than he did, and I didn't see fire anywhere.
Wow.
But you know, we survived that, and we protected the buildings. But it's kind of one of those things that I say, little tongue-in-cheek, but not really, and that is the fire is the gift that keeps on giving. It has consumed my existence for the last 14 months, 15 months, because of the threat of additional fires and the fact that our insurance has just escalated to the point of an existential threat to our industry for small wineries like us. And we put in 6 fire hydrants now. The building has sprinklers. If you turn around and look up on the building there, there's one sprinkler. On the other side are 2 other sprinklers. See on the far left corner up there?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And then we have sprinklers in the back. The barn has 2 sprinklers on them. We're spending as much money as I can possibly spend clearing out the forest and making sure that we have fire breaks, fuel breaks, green shaded breaks. We're doing everything we can to make sure that we will never lose anything to the fire. But that takes a lot of energy and a lot of time. And with the drought, it's been exacerbated. So in some ways, I've turned into a bit of a nervous Nelly with this whole thing.
Well, how can you not?
Yeah.
50 years is amazing for the wine business in the United States because of surviving Prohibition and how the wheels finally got turning. And of course, the Tasting of Paris and all. He found somebody or something.
Yeah.
You've seen a lot of change in this business. Tell me about what you've seen.
Well, it's really been quite profound. And I kind of feel my undergraduate degree was in economics and I did macroeconomics. And it's interesting to see the change that's occurred. So Prohibition was repeal was December 5th, 1933. And from 33 until Bob Mondavi started the Robert Mondavi Winery in 66, it was kind of a reconstruction of the industry, trying to figure out cooperage and tanks and how to make wine and what was going wrong and all that other stuff. And then with Bob starting that Renaissance period, as I think of it, there were a lot of changes and a lot of techniques. And we went from a sleepy little kind of agricultural community to within 25 years into a world preeminent wine growing region. That having been said, from a small winery point of view, things that are important to us, we went from hand labeling to bottling trucks that came around and did the bottling for us. So when we started, so if this is the corking machine and this is the rotary spiller, I would be very good at doing this all day long. And we had a Girondin corker, and if you left the bottle there, it put a cork in and another cork in and another cork in. And every time it did that, it splashed you. Sooner or later, you would wake up and say, oops, there's something wrong here.
Yeah, I'd say.
And then we would pack off, maybe do 350 cases a day. And then we come back another day, the next day or whatever, dump it all out, put the foils on them, put the labels on them. And I hated putting the labels on because I could never get them straight. And Charlie didn't like bottling, filling, and corking as I did, but I hated labeling, and he didn't mind labeling, and he put his labels on straighter than I could, and he had fewer glue prints all over his bottles than I had on mine.
Yeah.
So starting about 1990 is when the first bottling trucks came around, and now we can run at 90 to 100 bottles a minute. The fit and finish is perfect. We can do 3,000 cases in a day. We can in 2 days we can do the entire year's bottling production. And in those days, to do that, we would be 30 days of bottling and filling. It was a nightmare.
Yeah, I'll bet.
So that was a huge change. I think the other thing that's changed from the winery side are the stemmer crushers. If there's one piece of equipment that's changed that's making a difference in wine quality, it's we're having stemmer crushers which more gently move the berries off the stems and into the hopper and the must line. Must line. Once the grapes are off the berries, it's called must, M-U-S-T. And the reason that's important is because we're not breaking the stems. And when the stems go into if stems go into white wine, who cares? We're going to press off in 20 minutes. They're not going to have any impact on the flavor or quality of the white wines. But when you have broken stems, or what we would call jacks, get into the fermenting must, it's in there for however long you ferment the grapes for, which could be 2 weeks, or it could go 3 weeks if you do extended skin contact. Yeah, yeah. And so that gives you a stemmy character, a tannin character, which was a little too pervasive. So that's one area. The other area in growing grapes, and it's a little bit like with dry farming, I have been, you know, screaming at the top of my lungs to anybody who will listen, which is apparently no one, because we can't get the yeast people to understand what we want is yeast to be less efficient, not more efficient. And what I mean by that is, when I was at UC Davis, we used a yeast conversion, in other words, from sugar to alcohol, of around 0.55. And so we would normally get, if you brought in grapes at 24 degrees Brix, you'd get like 13.5, 13.7. Now the yeast are going up around so efficient, they're at like 0.62, 63. And the same sugar that you were getting 13.5, you're now getting 14 and a quarter, 14 and a half, or sometimes even higher. And so we want the yeast to do what we want them to do, but we don't want them to be so efficient that we have too high a level of alcohol. And so the yeast, we really need the yeast companies to come up with a yeast which is less efficient and gives us the same thing that we want a yeast to do, but producing less alcohol. And that would be a really big one. The other issue, and that's just a tangent off of this conversation, is the whole issue on wild yeast. Now, when we were making Pinot Noir, we had, Charlie and I had no one to look to in California to say, yeah, they were doing it right. We had to come up with a strategy, an idea, a philosophy. And that philosophy was, it's just Pinot Noir. If we get too uptight about it, we're never going to find the way to make it good. So we have to have a really cavalier attitude toward it. And that way, maybe we will be that pig that finds the chanterelle. So we did a wild fermentation. Because it was wild and we're in the West, I called it a Bronco fermentation. And it worked like clockwork. And that is 3.5 days into the must sitting there doing nothing. The first thing that happened is ethyl acetate, nail polish remover, kicked off. And that was the true wild yeast, Cleckera. And that was an indication that it was going. Now, the nice thing about Cleckera is it gets it going. Unfortunately, it kicks out ethyl acetate, but that gets blown off because Cleckera dies out at 1.5% alcohol. And then Saccharomyces cerevisiae or you know, regular wine yeast take over. And now we have a whole big push by people saying, oh, it should be all wild yeast and all of this other stuff, to which I say, malarkey. The wine, nobody can taste a wine and go, aha, this was done with Montrachet. No, this was done with champagne yeast. And in fact, when people ask us what we use, I say we use captured wild yeast. Because Montrachet was captured by the yeast companies in Burgundy with the white wine. And champagne was captured in Champagne, and then they processed it, refined it, and came up with the natural yeast. So what's different between a captured cultured yeast that's now in the dry farm versus a wet yeast that's just running around in the vineyard? Nothing. So that's one issue from a vineyard, back to this 50 years thing. There are no machines out there that have transformed winemaking to allow us to make better wine, in my opinion, except for the advancements in the stemmer crusher. From the vineyard side of things, we're learning how to be in more environmentally sensitive to the environment. Up on the mountains, we've been non-till since the late 70s. Well, probably 79, 80, right after the last really big drought, we went non-till. And we've been non-till ever since. And then we've also learned that we can use four-wheel drive wheel tractors. And that just simply was not possible when we started. And that allows us with non-till to lay out our vineyards in the best way for sun exposure on the grapes. Now, prior to that period of time in the late 70s, no one cared which way your rose directions went. But what we learned is that we need to get dappled sunlight in on the grapes so that you can get rid of what's called pyrazine. And that's done by getting dappled sunlight on the vines. And if your rows are running east-west and you're at 38.5 degrees latitude that we are, then all your sunlight is on the south-facing grapes. Nothing hits the north side. And you go, that's not good. So if you go north-south, then you have an equal amount of sunlight on the morning side and an equal amount on the afternoon side. But being the smart ass that I am, I'm going to take the morning shift and give you guys the afternoon shift. Now, I get the morning when it's cool, it's nice, there's moisture in the air, the vines have sucked up all the moisture that they need from the night before, and you guys come on in the afternoon and wait a minute. You're going, this is supposed to be California, it's supposed to be fair. And it's not fair that the afternoon gets so much heat and there's so little water. So we go, okay, what we do is we're going to kick it off to a northeast-southwest direction. And that allows for about 55% of the sunlight on the morning side and 40% on the afternoon side. So there's not the intensity of the heat. And then we have a trellis system, which is rather extensive, that goes up in an umbrella shape so that it comes over and also shades the vines. So we can now plant our rows up and down a hill if that's what it takes to get into that row direction and not worry about soil erosion. But I do think that maybe, and this is an area that we simply don't know, maybe if you're closer to the coast or a cooler area, you're going to be more to that north-south basis. Mm-hmm. And somewhere based on slope, direction, heat, you're going to have a different angle. But that I can't figure out. My brain isn't good enough for that. So there's that. And then obviously, we have in California, not so much outside of California, but in California, we have a huge amount of high wealth, high net worth individuals coming into the wine business and celebrities. Right. And sports figures and movie star figures and symphony conductor figures. And as I like to say somewhat, guys, it's a tough industry, and it's God's way of telling you have too much money if you're getting into the industry like this, because you really don't know what it is. The other thing about the wine business, and that is that it's a people business.
Right.
If you don't like people, you shouldn't be in the business.
You have to be able to spend time with people and talk with them and educate them.
And educate them.
Yeah, that's a big part of it.
And it's all about friendship and people. And there's nothing better for me as a grape grower and a winemaker, or as some of us refer to ourselves as wine growers, we get to play in dirt being a farmer, and we get to make wine, which is just magical. And then we get to put it on a dining room table and have it with family and friends. And that is the kind of the pinnacle of an enjoyment of satisfaction of life, because, you know, there is where, you know, kind of the ultimate joy of life is dealing with other people and having good conversations and making the hardships of the day fade away.
That comes out with wine, that's for sure. Stu, for our listeners who'd like to learn more about you and Smith Madrone online, how would our listeners do that?
Well, they can go to our website, which we keep updated all the time, which is smithmadrone.com. And we're always putting stuff up there, and go through there and take a look at everything. And we're trying to always bring it up. And in fact, my goal for this coming year, 2022, is to get more information up there for just the kind of things that we're talking about. How we, you know, what our philosophy and how do we grow grapes up here? You know, what's our philosophy? How do we make wine? Just the kind of things that we're talking about.
That's the international telephone symbol there.
Oh, is that?
I was going to say, do you want to give a phone number?
Oh,
that's my,
yeah.
I'm mentally sending it to you.
I am a little dense this afternoon.
I'll
connect with that real quick. Right. And then the winery, you know, if I have time, I'm happy to talk to people on the phone. 707-963-2283 is our phone number.
And you've always said that you like talking to people.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Stu, thanks for this glorious day up here on the mountain. Thanks for taking the time to chat.
You're welcome. Thanks for coming. Again.
And again. I'll be back.
Good. Good.
Cool. That's it.
And we made it just before the UPS driver showed up.
Learn more by visiting smithmadrone.com.